WHYY.
I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie has had a busy week. An investigation that he commissioned found that he was not responsible for the traffic jam at the George Washington Bridge last September, a scandal now known as Bridgegate. He was back to his combative self at a press conference shortly after the report's release. His appointee at the Port Authority, David Sampson, announced that he was stepping down. Christie flew to Las Vegas over the weekend for an event organized by the Republican-Jewish Coalition, where he and other speakers hope to win the support of billionaire Sheldon Adelson. And on Tuesday night, he was back in New Jersey to celebrate former New Jersey Governor Brendan Byrne's 90th birthday. We asked Matt Katz and Daryl Isherwood to get us up to speed on Bridgegate, on Christie, and more New Jersey news. And joining us here in our Philadelphia studios, Matt Katz. He covers the governor for WNYC and for New Jersey Public Radio. Matt, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty.
Good morning. And also joining us, Daryl Isherwood by telephone, senior political reporter at NJ.com. And Daryl, nice to have you back with us as well.
Thanks for having me.
Matt, if I could begin with you, and I know that you have been looking through some of the documents that accompanied Randy Mastro's report, the report that came out last week that basically said Christie was not responsible for Bridgegate, but you've been combing through some of these documents. What have you found?
Right. The report itself was about 300 pages, and it read something akin to a defense lawyer's brief defending his client. It really exonerated Christie from any wrongdoing in this whole scandal. But the more interesting stuff is in the supporting documents, because they did 70 interviews and collected emails and text messages from all kinds of government employees. They didn't interview the five biggest figures in the scandal, but they interviewed a lot of other people. They even got the governor's iPhone and went through it, supposedly, according to his lawyer. So the supporting documents have some really interesting stuff. And what we found in one instance was how aggressively the governor and his campaign staff and government staff were trying to get endorsements for his reelection campaign last year. And that's really interesting, because the thrust of the reelection campaign was getting endorsements. Christie wanted Democratic mayors to endorse him so he could win by huge margins and so he could run for president in 2016 and portray himself as a uniter, as a conservative Republican who could win in a blue state and win with all these Democrats standing with him. So we see as early as January of 2013, he is having a meeting with the Hoboken mayor about Sandy Aid.
Dawn Zimmer.
And this is a woman who later complained that she was threatened to approve a redevelopment project unless otherwise Sandy Aid was going to be taken away by the Christie administration. This is an accusation that Christie officials have totally rejected, but it shows that Sandy Aid and politics were mixing in the governor's office in January 2013. He has a meeting with her. He asks for her endorsement. She's noncommittal. They are then really kind of going after her, and there's a lot of email traffic between the government staff and the political staff about the status of the endorsement. When she finally decides not to endorse, they are furious with her. They say, we've been kissing her butt for all these months and she's not endorsing us. This is ridiculous. That's what his campaign manager says. Then she wants to go to an event that he's having across from City Hall, and the governor himself says that she shouldn't come, she should be disinvited because she didn't endorse him. At the same time, we're seeing how they're aggressively going after the mayor of Fort Lee. And the mayor of Fort Lee, of course, is the mayor who was stuck with this massive traffic jam when the George Washington Bridge lanes were closed in September. And they're going after him beginning in January or February, and government employees who work in Christie's office in Trenton are actually in charge of getting that endorsement. Now, supposedly they're working on their own time, but emails indicate that they're having lunch. There's a lunch with a government employee where they talk about the endorsement. Supposedly, the mayor brought it up, but they talk about the endorsement during government hours on a Tuesday afternoon. So there's a lot of intermingling here, and that's some interesting stuff about how, you know, politics and government intertwine in the Christie administration.
Daryl, let me get you in on the conversation, and even going back to the report that came out last week, the report authored by Randy Mastro. Now, it was paid for by New Jersey taxpayers, I think about $1 million. Mm-hmm. And there were people, as Matt said, that he did not interview, although interestingly, posting lots of emails and documents that are accompanying this report. What is your takeaway of this report?
Well, a couple of things. You know, as Matt said, this was a very pro-Christie report, and I think that's the major criticism of it. It's written in such a way, there's a narrative that they write, and the narrative goes, it's very much pro-Christie, and there are details included in it that I think are drawing some criticism, not because of, they're necessarily important details, but because they're not so much important details. Things like, when Christie called a meeting of his staff at Drumthwacket to demand if anybody was involved in this thing, he had tears in his eyes, and things like that, that make it look as if they were really writing this to put Christie in a good light, and to put others, namely Bridget Kelly and Dawn Zimmer, who Matt talked about. Bridget Kelly, of course, is the staffer who sent the now infamous "Time for Some Traffic Problems in Fort Lee" email back last August. The report really savages Bridget Kelly. It savages Dawn Zimmer. It savages David Wildstein, the Port Authority official who ultimately arranged for the lane diversions, while really casting Christie in this sort of unwitting victim light. And so, there is that criticism out there that this was done to really exonerate Christie, as Matt said. Now, I'll throw you something on the other side of that.
Go ahead.
I think, this talk of it's a whitewash, it was a, you get all of these adjectives being thrown around really disparaging the report. And all that may be true, but I don't believe, and I don't have inside information clearly, but I don't believe that Randy Mastro, who is, by all accounts, an $1,200 an hour New York City lawyer, got a great reputation, I don't believe that Randy Mastro found a smoking gun and stuck it in his hip pocket while doing this investigation. So that accusation hasn't necessarily been out there, but I don't think that Randy Mastro is going to completely exonerate Chris Christie if the smoking gun is now lying in his briefcase.
But I think the question, Daryl, is did he, and I'm not saying Christie's involved or not, but did he dig deep enough to know whether he could answer that question or not?
Yeah, and I think the fact that they labeled this report exhaustive and comprehensive is a little misleading. As Matt said, they didn't interview the four or five people who really know what happened. Now, they couldn't. Those people were not going to be interviewed, so it's not like they didn't necessarily try to get them and were not able to. But yeah, there's definitely some holes in this report, some clear holes. I mean, David Sampson wasn't interviewed, David Wildstein wasn't interviewed, Bridget Kelly wasn't interviewed, Bill Stepien, former campaign manager, who at least had some prior knowledge of this thing, wasn't interviewed. So to label it as exhaustive and comprehensive, I think, is a little misleading.
Go ahead, Matt.
I think there are two questions here, and Daryl's right. He didn't seem to find, with the restrictions he had, these lawyers wouldn't let them talk. Christie's attorney didn't seem to find any evidence that that Christie was involved in ordering this. And I agree. I don't think he would have hidden any evidence if he did find it, because that would have come back to haunt him later. But there's a second question here that has gotten more focus recently, and it's something that the report just kind of let go and ignored, and that's whether there was a cover-up after high-ranking government officials found out that this was a bogus plan to exact political retribution. And the report sort of ignored that question. It didn't really delve into the accusation from David Wildstein, this guy at the Port Authority, the Christie appointee who supposedly ordered the lane closures. He told Christie's spokesman that he talked to the governor about the lane closures while they were happening at a September 11th ceremony at Ground Zero.
In fact, there's a photo of them together.
And there's a photo of them together, and it came out in the report that he actually told officials that part of their conversation was about these lane closures. And the report mentions that but doesn't delve into it. Like, how long did this conversation go? Christie says he doesn't remember it. Were there other people around? Did they try to talk to other people around who might have heard this? This seems like a big piece of evidence, but it goes to the second question of the cover-up, not to who ordered it. And the report really was more focused on who ordered the lane closures.
Yeah, and there's a section in that report that talks about this, and it's sort of almost funny in the way it's worded. It completely exonerates the governor even on that issue. It says, well, this sort of issue wouldn't rise to the level of the governor. It sort of makes this assumption that, well, the governor wouldn't have gotten himself involved in this, therefore we didn't really need to go any further with this. And that's, I think, one of the passages, and there are a lot of others, where these leaps of faith or assumptions are made that completely exonerate the governor, that I'm not really sure how you make those without actually interviewing the people involved. And I think that's one of the big criticisms that Matt said.
Well, and another leap of faith, and this has been talked about before, is this report looks at Bridget Kelly's personal life, and apparently she had a relationship with Bill Stepien that was that ended, or he ended it, and the implication being that somehow she was so sort of lovesick that she caused a traffic jam in Fort Lee. I mean, that her state of mind caused her to send out this email. And I just have to say, in the year 2014, that just seems extremely medieval, if I can say that, Matt.
Yeah, this got a lot of attention because it was unclear why this sort of gossip was put in. They didn't talk to either of the people who supposedly had this relationship, and it was unclear what relevance it had, and that's what both of their attorneys said. Why are you putting this in? One theory was it was a way of distracting so the tabloids would focus on this and not the other meat of the report, and that's exactly what happened, by the way. Another theory was that it was a way of intimidating Bridget Kelly. What I found interesting was that every reporter in Trenton had heard about this.
Right.
I'm sure, Daryl, you knew about it.
Absolutely.
I mean, we all knew about it.
It wasn't a well-kept secret at all.
But they had a relationship.
Right. But we didn't report it. I mean, I could speak for myself. I'm sure it's the same thing for Daryl. We didn't. There seemed to be no other reason to report it other than to titillate. And there seemed to be, from my journalistic perspective, no relevance here. And yet, Chrissy's attorney thought it was relevant.
And they didn't provide any relevance in saying it. It was sort of just thrown in there. There really wasn't even an explanation for its inclusion. You know, it wasn't like they said why it mattered. They just sort of threw it in there and then left it dangling out there. You know?
Well, and I wonder if there isn't something personal. I remember Chris Christie talking about Wildstein, you know, basically saying I was the football captain and the president of the school, and who was this guy Wildstein that I went to high school with? And there's something obviously very personal about talking about someone's personal life or romantic life and including that in a report. Daryl?
Yeah, and it's, you know, they as you said, Marty, they threw it out there as sort of explanation, which I don't see how it provides any explanation for what happened. As you said, they make it look as if she's this jilted lover who then, you know, takes out her wrath on the poor commuters. And again, they didn't provide any context for it. It didn't say the breakup caused this, and therefore, you know, it didn't take it any further. It just said, hey, they dated, and Bill Stepien allegedly had ended this relationship, and, you know, there's nothing untoward about the relationship. I think they say it in the thing. They both weren't married at the time. I mean, short of it being two staffers, there really wasn't anything untoward about the relationship that's alleged. So, you know, Michael Critchley, Bridget Kelly's lawyer, really came out strongly against it, and saying, you know, A, this is sexist, and B, you know, what are you doing airing this kind of stuff in a report? As Matt said, this is sort of par for the course, though, and I'll just give you a real quick point.
Actually, Daryl, hold on to that point, only because we're up in a break here, and we are talking about, for the lack of a better word, Bridgegate, and our guests are Daryl Isherwood, senior political reporter at NJ.com, and Matt Katz, who has been covering Governor Christie for WNYC, that's the public radio station in New York, and also for New Jersey Public Radio. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY. Radio Times. We'll be right back.
Touchstone Center for Crafts supports WHYY, a residential craft school located in Farmington, Pennsylvania, 4.5 hours from Philadelphia in the Laurel Highlands. Offering workshops in a variety of traditional and emerging craft forms, including mosaic arts, fiber arts, and ceramics on its 150-acre woodland campus. Touchstone Center for Crafts, the natural setting for your creative nature. Information at touchstonecrafts.org.
Thank you for making the winter campaign a success. This is Ed Cunningham. Last week, our membership drive returned for 2 days so we could make up the shortfall we experienced in February. The result? We were able to finish the drive. Over 7,600 listeners chose to call in or make a pledge online during the winter campaign. We will reinvest those pledges right back into the services you expect. Learn more about WHYY membership at WHYY.org, and thank you.
Montgomery School supports WHYY, an independent school for pre-K through grade 8 in Chester Springs. Montgomery believes the fine and performing arts are an integral part of learning. The program allows all students to develop and express creativity through music, drama, and fine arts. Montgomery will host a pre-K visit day on April 5th at 10 a.m. and an open house on April 10th at 7 p.m. Details at montgomeryschool.org/admissions. Montgomery School, inspired to explore, prepared to succeed.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and we're getting up to speed on some events in New Jersey, Bridgegate, as it is called, Governor Christie, and a very busy week of news. And again, talking with Matt Katz and Daryl Isherwood. Daryl, you wanted to say something. Go ahead.
Yeah, there's always been this, and this is a tried and true tactic of the governor's, this shiny object theory that Matt threw out there that, you know, we in the media fall for it a lot. There's a major story going on, and the governor comes out and calls somebody a name, and the headline is the name, and the leads of our stories are all the name that he called whoever it was. And we sort of, you know, the storyline is secondary. And there's some of that, I think, in this. You know, throw this out there, and people will bite on it, and we'll beat up Bridget Kelly a little bit, and some of the shortcomings of this report will be either glossed over or further down in the story. And it's, you know, that's a tried and true tactic. And I don't necessarily say the governor had a hand in crafting this thing, but that has been a tried and true tactic in this administration, without question.
We have a tweet from Walter, and actually, Matt, this is what you and I were talking about during the break. Walter says, remember when Christie prosecuted others for using staff to campaign on government time? And you've been going through these emails and looking at what people were doing and what their responsibilities were.
Right, and Christie's, the lawyers for the Republican Party in New Jersey say that what they were volunteering on their own time when they did this stuff, and that they weren't, if government workers were working for the campaign, it was on their own time, and this is the way it's been done in previous administrations. But the emails indicate that a lot of this was happening like during work hours, and we don't know.
Is that
if
illegal?
It's potentially illegal unless they had taken a half a day, or that the conversation came up, you know, as part of another conversation about government, and maybe the mayor brought it up. I mean, if there's any, if there's a quid pro quo inferred or demanded, then that's when you get into legal problems. Mm-hmm. And we don't see that, but we certainly see something that prosecutors may be interested in looking at. I mean, they're already looking. They have, we know, two investigations going on to the administration, one into Bridgegate and one into these allegations from the Hoboken mayor that she was that Christie officials tried to shake her down to approve a development deal, and they were going to take away Sandiate if she didn't. And maybe they're looking at this, too. I mean, the sort of large irony of all this is Christie was the corruption-fighting federal prosecutor for New Jersey, and his administration had not – he used to brag about his administration had not a whiff of scandal for 3.5-plus years. And then all of this happened, and he's being investigated by the same office that he used to run. And he's – and, you know, people have often said, you know, Chris Christie would be indicting Chris Christie right now. And I don't know if that's true. I don't understand all the law. But it is – there's a certain degree of irony to all of that.
And we should say the U.S. attorney is a guy named Paul Fishman. Darryl, you want to add something to that?
I do. You know, and it's funny. Randy Mastro acknowledges some of this stuff in the report. I mean, one of his recommendations in this report was that this disbanding of the Office of Intergovernmental Affairs, where a lot of this stuff was allegedly going on. It was that office run by Bridget Kelly that was out there looking for these endorsements and doing, and it was some of those employees. And so Randy Mastro acknowledges the fact that they were, you know, I think in the report he says that the IGA needs to get back to the original mission of providing constituent services. And they strayed far and wide from that mission, at least during the campaign.
I'm looking at a poll that came out from Monmouth University, and Matt, I'll toss this to you. The poll indicating that 61% of New Jersey residents think that Chris Christie has not been honest about this matter we've been talking about, and at the same time, 51% of New Jerseyites or New Jerseyans approve of the job that Christie is doing. So it's an interesting Bit of a conflict there, or conflicting responses.
It goes to show how much goodwill this guy built up over 4 years, and particularly because of the way he handled things after Sandy. You know, out there in front of the cameras, a perception of very strong leadership, a willingness to bro hug Obama on the tarmac in Atlantic City 6 days before the presidential election, a willingness to call out members of his own party in Congress for not providing Sandy funds, and the amount of goodwill he had built up, people really across, from both sides of the aisle adored this guy. And you know, he's been taken down a lot by the scandal, but the fact that he still has 51% approval rating by some of the same people who think he might be lying about the scandal is amazing. And it goes to show how strong he is going into 2016 presidential race. He's still more popular in blue New Jersey than a lot of his potential competitors are in their own states.
Daryl, does it tell us something about New Jerseyans, though?
You know, I think it does a little bit. I think, you know, the governor has all along said, hey, look, people don't care about this, what we're calling Bridgegate. They have real problems. And I don't know that that's necessarily true, but I think that there is an element of, you know, as Matt said, people think the guy is not telling the truth, and yet they still approve of the job he's doing, or at least a handful of them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think there's something to be said for that. I also think that, you know, we all wrote about the plummeting approval ratings of the governor. You know, he dropped from in the, what was it, Matt, in the 60s after his reelection campaign to now at 51%. 51% is still not a shabby approval rating.
Not at all.
There's a lot of politicians in this country who would kill for a 51%.
Including the president.
Including the president, exactly.
Including
right.
the governor of Pennsylvania, I should add to that as well. Let me get Chris from Burlington County to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Chris, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I think you're wasting everyone's time on this. You have, this has been going on and on. You really haven't uncovered everything. If you really want to investigate something, what happened to the Sandy money that didn't get into the proper hands that should actually have people rebuild their homes? You know, there's so many other things going on in the state of New Jersey, and you keep on talking about, oh, this Bridgegate. It's a joke. It really is a joke. You guys are bending straws trying to find anything to get after Christie, and I find it extremely tiring.
Well, you know what, Chris? Let me just say back to you that this is, I think, maybe the second or third show that we have done about "quote unquote" Bridgegate since September. So I stand by the fact that we're doing the show today. We did ask Andy Mastro to join us for a portion of the show. He did decline our invitation, which is totally fine. But I wanted to let you know and let our listeners know that we did want to speak to the author of the report, and we're unable to book him for the show. But you know, we're not to the bottom of this yet, Matt. But it seems to me there are still important unanswered questions.
Right. I would say that Chris is somewhat reflective of a lot of what I've heard from a lot of New Jerseyans. I mean, you know, Christie's done four or five. I'm going to another one today that's about Sandy, so I'll be covering Sandy issues today. But I think he's done four or five town hall meetings since the scandal broke, and he's been asked one question about Bridgegate. So, you know, maybe the larger populace doesn't, this is not their most important issue, and certainly Sandy Aid and the fact that people are still homeless is a huge deal. But this goes to a larger question of abuse of power and whether public officials paid for by tax dollars and toll dollars were abusing their office to exact political revenge. I mean, we should remember that there were ambulances that were stuck in traffic for over a period of 4 or 5 days. There were kids who were late to school. There was a public safety concerns by public officials in these towns that were hit with this traffic jam. This is not just a throwaway issue that didn't have consequences. It affected at the time tens of thousands of people. And if it reflects some larger issues involving abuse of power, either at the Port Authority or the governor's office, then I think it's worth examining in forums like this.
Chris, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Daryl, there's so many unanswered questions. And as Chris indicated, I mean, there are many things that we are speculating about, but we don't have actual evidence about. What are some of the questions that you still have about what may or may not have happened?
Well, you know, the most obvious one is motive. I mean, we have yet to figure out why this happened, and nobody's even, you know, the report didn't touch on it at all, which was obviously one of the other criticisms. We don't know what happened and why whoever ordered it. And, And I think that's an kind of, you know, important question that that has been left out there unanswered. You know, the old who knew what when answer or question. We just don't know who ultimately ordered this thing. And as Matt said, I mean, you know, going back to the caller's question, this thing really goes to more than just 4 days worth of traffic. I mean, you know, this goes, there's a couple of issues here, as he said. It goes to the abuse of power. It goes to the patronage issue. It goes to this this morass that the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey has become. So, you know, there's other issues there and other questions. You know, I think one of the unanswered questions is, what was David Sampson's role? You know, nobody, he has yet not agreed to be interviewed about it. He's spoken to the governor, but that obviously wasn't in any public situation. So what was David Sampson's role? You know, in the emails that were released back in January, David Wildstein clearly says, Sampson is helping us to retaliate. And Sampson has denied any, you know, it was addressed during the governor's press conference, and the governor said he asked Sampson, and Sampson had no idea what that meant. But, you know, the fact that David Wildstein threw that out there on September 15th, I think, is obviously an unanswered question. What did that mean? And, you know, so I think there's, we, as people have said all along, I think this report raised as many questions as it answered.
And we should add that David Sampson, who was Chris Christie's appointee at the Port Authority, has announced that he is stepping down. Daryl Isherwood, senior political reporter at NJ.com. Matt Katz covers Governor Christie for WNYC and New Jersey Public Radio. And we are talking about New Jersey politics, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Daryl, and to our listeners, Matt and I actually were talking before the show began about port authorities. There's a port authority here in Philadelphia between New Jersey and Pennsylvania, and of course talking about the port authority up by the GW Bridge, which controls 4 bridges, 5 airports, 2 tunnels, and the ports as well. They have billions of dollars. A very similar situation down here as well. It hasn't gotten to the point of Bridgegate, but certainly some allegations, scandals, questions raised in the last couple of years. Does raise questions about these port authorities.
Yes, they're fascinating. I mean, they're essentially highly political appointees who control a ton of money with very little transparency. And that's in both the, I've covered the DRPA and now covering the Port Authority, and that's been their histories. The Port Authority of New York and New Jersey has a larger budget than half of the United States.
$8.2 billion, I think.
Unbelievable amount of money. And because they have this sort of bi-state partnership, the governors appoint their own people. They sort of operate separately and have this, in recent years, had this intense rivalry, which means that they kind of are able to spend on their own. It's almost like the Palestinians and the Israelis.
Wow.
I mean, they kind of have their own separate economy, but are totally intertwined. And they also, in a way, there's no watchdog, really, because they're both don't want the other to kind of tattle on them, which is what's interesting here. Now, Christie has said that Cuomo's top appointee was the one who first leaked the Patrick Foy is the one who first leaked the information that this was a political retaliation scheme to the Wall Street Journal back when it happened. And that's kind of why this all exploded. But in the past, it's been that both states kind of, you know, look out for each other. And, all right, we won't tell them what you're up to if you don't tell them what we're up to. And we've seen that with Pennsylvania and New Jersey and the DRPA as well. And they spend money on things that aren't related to transportation, which is, you know, like the Jewish Museum in Philadelphia that the DRPA spent money on, or all kinds of road projects miles and miles away from the Port Authority in North Jersey, from the bridges and tunnels in North Jersey. And we're not really, there's a now debate about how to rein them in. Do you split them apart? Do you put more oversight? all of it's going to require legislation from two states and possibly from Congress, so it's extremely complicated.
Mm-hmm. And full disclosure here, WHYY received some money from the DRPA for a construction project here as well. Daryl, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah,
we have a lot of callers.
A couple of things. One of them being, and Matt touched on this too, this is their history. None of this stuff is new. It's, you know, this goes back in all of these agencies, and the Port Authority has always had that sort of reputation. And what's ironic about that reputation is, during his press conferences, the governor used that reputation as kind of his defense as to why he didn't take this more seriously in the beginning. He said, there's always been this rivalry, and I just thought that this was a continuation of that. I didn't realize that this rose to, you know, I think he was sort of referring to Foy's memo, that this was just more internal sniping. And so, you know, he didn't really need to take it seriously because this stuff's been going on for time in memoriam. The other point there is, you know, David Wildstein was hired at the Port Authority essentially to do politics. I mean, and it, so, you know, you've got this guy who comes in there and he's got this amorphous job description. In fact, I don't think there was a job description when he was hired. They created this job for him, and there was no oversight. He had a boss in Bill Baroni who hired him, but there was really no oversight as to what he was doing there. And he was sort of doing, you know, the governor's politics, doing the administration politics while at the Port Authority.
Let me get, looks like Linda from Princeton to join our conversation. Hi, Linda, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm willing to bet 2 cents on the following proposition, and I wanted to ask both the guests about it. When Governor Christie said at his press conference that Bridget Kelly had betrayed him, and a second, I believe he said that Fort Lee was not on the list of possible targets for political, on the radar for political retribution. I have a funny feeling that there was brainstorming going on involving Bridget Kelly, others, underlings, and they passed the idea of this lane closure by Christie, who may or may not have said, no, we're not getting involved in anything like that, that they went ahead and did it anyway, without his knowledge, in which case he should have been asked to ferret out some information by reporters. Governor Christie, were you aware that such an idea had ever even been considered by any of your underlings?
Well, and of course,
to which he would have to have said, yes, but I said, we're not going to do anything like that, or he may not have known anything about it at all. They may have done the brainstorming independently.
Yeah, but Linda, you know, you're basing your question on speculation. We don't know whether this happened or not. But I'm looking at you, Matt Katz. Anything you want to say in response?
Yeah, he's sort of, that question hasn't been directly put to him like that, but he has intimated that he didn't even know there were dedicated lanes, the ones that were closed. He didn't even know that there were dedicated lanes to the bridge from Fort Lee until after all of this came out in October and November. So I pretty much would bet he would say nobody ever brought that idea to him. If someone did bring the idea to him and he said yes or no on it, I think what we could be certain of is that there's no paper trail. I think this would be the kind of thing that would not have been in an email. So we may never really know for sure, unless if you're not taking him by his word.
And Daryl, we're almost up in a break here, but I always had a question. When he fired Bridget Kelly, he didn't ask her. My understanding is he did not ask her about that now explosive email.
Yeah, correct. He at the time sort of justified that, saying, well, she lied to me. When I asked her if she was involved, she said, no, that's a lie. The lie is enough for me to fire her. I didn't need to know anymore. And then he's since sort of backtracked on that and, you know, at the time wouldn't comment on the action. It was only the lie, that not the actual bridge link diversions. Since then, he's been asked, what do you think of the lane diversions? And he's come out strongly against it, obviously. But, yeah, at the time, there was no questioning of Bridget Kelly. And I think that was sort of a glaring hole in the governor's story. You know, why didn't the next logical question here is, why'd you do it, Bridget? What's this about? And he didn't. And tried to justify that, but I don't think it really, you know, I don't think it worked.
And that's Daryl Isherwood, senior political reporter at NJ.com. Matt Katz also with us. He covers Governor Christie for WNYC and New Jersey Public Radio. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And stay with us. We'll be right back.
Burnaby Volvo, minutes away from Northeast Philadelphia in Huntington Valley, supports WHYY and features a large selection of new and pre-owned Volvo models. Their full inventory at burnamyvolvo.com. Burnaby Volvo, 215-947-6363.
The Philadelphia Speaker Series, presented by Widener University, is proud to support WHYY. Building on its reputation for bringing to Philadelphia some of the world's most interesting people, the Philadelphia Speaker Series, presented by Widener University, returns to the Kimmel Center next season. 7 engaging and thought-provoking evenings with Alan Alda, Senator Olympia Snowe, David McCullough, and Ken Burns. PhiladelphiaSpeakerSeries.org, sponsored by the Haverford Trust Company.
Steve, let me ask you something. When you're hosting NPR's Morning Edition, how do you keep all those news stories straight in your head?
By listening. I don't pretend to know all the answers. My job is to know who to ask and how to ask them. At NPR's Morning Program, our job is to push for real stories, honest answers.
And you can listen with us on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Weekday mornings on WHYY.
Gaudenzia supports WHYY. In Pennsylvania, 1 in 4 families is affected by drug or alcohol addiction. For over 45 years, Gaudenzia has helped people to build the skills needed to live in long-term recovery. The Gaudenzia helpline is 215-806-5342.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain talking with Matt Katz and Daryl Isherwood about the twists and turns of Bridgegate. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Matt, let me go back to you because obviously Wildstein and Kelly are so pivotal. There is this legislative committee looking into this issue. The feds are looking into, I guess, related to Don Zimmer and whether Sandy money was used for political reasons. Is there any question about Wildstein and Kelly being given immunity so that they can testify? Is that an issue?
Yes, and both of their attorneys have basically publicly asked for that.
They asked for it, okay.
Right. So the next step in all of this, the feds are also looking at Bridgegate, but that's going to take some time, we expect. So the next step in this is the legislative committee, and they've subpoenaed I think 36 people for documents. But the two most important people, Bridget Kelly and Bill Stepien, Bridget Kelly, the former deputy chief of staff, and Bill Stepien, the campaign manager, have refused to turn over documents. And we're awaiting a decision any day now from a Superior Court judge to decide whether they should be forced to turn over their documents. However that turns out, it'll probably be appealed and then appealed again to the state Supreme Court. But that is really a huge issue. If they can hold on to their documents, then that would mean the legislative committee's investigation is really inhibited. I mean, these guys, if we want to know, for the ultimate question is whether the governor was involved in this before, during, or after. That information is likely in the Stepien Kelly emails one way or another, and we'll see what this judge says.
Well, and what about Wildstein emails? How important are they, Daryl?
Well, he turned them over, and they blasted this thing wide open. You know, it was David Wildstein who turned over the time for some traffic problems email. So he, he's sort of been the pivotal figure in all this. He's come up with all these blockbuster pieces of information, the first one being that. The second one was his attorney saying that there was evidence that exists. I forget how it was worded. Evidence that exists that the governor knew about this before, during it going on. He also now is the person who is saying he told the governor on September 11th about this stuff. So his information has been pivotal. But his emails are out there. So really, as Matt said, I think it's Stepien and Kelly. Without those, I don't know where the investigation goes. If they don't get the emails turned over by those two people, I'm not sure where they go from here. And having said that, the governor is going to use that. If he's already got one report that clears him, if the U.S. attorney either goes in a different direction with his investigation or closes this case, bet that the governor's going to say, hey, look, I've got two investigations that exonerate me. What more do you need? And then we'll start getting the same partisan witch hunt storyline that we had for a while.
Let me get Mark from Yardley to join us. Mark, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
I'd like to posit before the information that this seems to be a pattern of behavior by Christie going all the way back to his initial step into politics. Way back in the day when he ran for a local office, he actually disparaged and defamed his opponents by claiming that they were under a criminal investigation, and after winning the election had to publish a public apology. And then further on, his ties to David Wildstein actually go back to when David Wildstein was writing as Wally Edge and seemed to have early information on every prosecuting case that Christie was involved in while he was acting as the prosecutor. It just seems that Chris Christie has really spent his entire political career either abusing the office that he was in or manipulating the information in order to gain further political growth. And he even at some point, there's the story about his brother Todd, who was initially under investigation for over 1,600 illegal trades, violating SEC ethics codes. And when Christie was a prosecutor, those mysteriously went away.
Well, Mark, let me give Matt Katch a chance to respond to that.
Yeah, I mean, the governor famously says politics ain't beanbag, and he plays rough and tough. And if you agree with him, you appreciate that. I mean, part of the reason why he was a successful in his first term, why he was successfully able to get major legislation through a Democratic legislature in a blue state is because he's so good at the game of politics. And some of that is not for the faint-hearted. I mean, some of it is rough stuff. And if you disagree with him and don't like that style, you have a problem with it. But if you agree with him, and if you have a more if you have a view of politics as something that is supposed to be, you know, a little bit dirty sometimes, then you appreciate it, because he is a master political tactician, and some of this stuff reflects that.
Daryl, do you think people, meaning maybe political people or just people in New Jersey, fear Chris Christie? Are they afraid of? They're afraid of him?
Absolutely. I mean, during his first term, that was a big storyline. You know, you were afraid to cross the governor. I mean, it really was. For a couple of reasons. I mean, he's not afraid to hammer his opponents, and that's become clear from day one. And, you know, it played itself out even during the election when people were reluctant to come out and endorse Barbara Bono because they assumed she would lose, and they didn't want to get on the bad side of the governor because of that fear. And I think clearly in political circles, I don't know about regular people,
right,
whether they pay enough attention, but, you know, Matt said the governor is just good at this game, and he gets dirty, and he's you know, he tells it like it is. He says what he thinks. He's, you know, he goes on the attack when necessary, and that's disconcerting to a lot of people, particularly if you end up on the wrong end of that. I mean, that we've seen that time and again, that, you know, people who end up on the wrong side of the governor are not in a good place, and he's got the biggest bully pulpit in the state.
Let me get George from Wrightstown to join us. George, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, my issue is, and it's aligned with this, the popularity of governor, he has been getting things done, and he has cooperated with the Democrats, and that's a refreshing thing. We have too much animosity on both sides of the political spectrum. People either like one party or the other, and they hate the opposite party. It's about time that people start focusing not on Bridgegate, because Corzine had his issues too, such as romantic involvement with a high-powered union person that was going to have a negotiation session. There's a conflict of interest there. It's all over. We have too many problems in this state and a myriad of issues. And I think this is just overblown. I traveled the Garden State or the George Washington Bridge for 30 years. I could never understand why traffic's tied up on every other approach to the bridge except Fort Lee. Fort Lee was smooth traffic, no tie-ups, and everybody else was waiting a half an hour, 45 minutes. I can never understand that.
Well, George, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and I think anyone that's gone over the GW Bridge knows the sort of nightmare of trying to traverse from New Jersey, well, I guess, to New York. Matt, again, I'm looking at you.
Yeah, there are issues that the governor has had success working across the aisle and dealing with. The problem now, because of this Bridgegate, is he's been weakened, it seems. The early indications are that he's been weakened. One of his major accomplishments of the first term was something called the interest arbitration cap that capped essentially capped how much pay increase police and firefighters could get from towns. And that expired last week because Democrats who had initially, you know, supported this thing couldn't come to compromise and deal and work with him on it. And now it's expired. And it's that it seems to me that that would have not happened either in a first term or if this Bridgegate thing hadn't happened. So, you know, whether he can continue to do the things the caller wanted him to continue to do is now in question because of Bridgegate.
Let me get Suzanne from New Jersey to join us. Hi, Suzanne. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I blame the press. I blame the press for building this guy up. Thinking it was just great when he was hollering at these town meetings at people that disagreed with him and at press conferences. As far as taxes go, where he keeps saying, I didn't raise taxes. My taxes went up. My real estate taxes went up. Unemployment is one of the worst states in the country. Now $1 million for this investigation. Then there was the Sandy campaign where he had his family. That was $250,000. More patronage jobs in the DRPA than any governor before him. And then finally, now at these town meetings, the state police taking pictures of the people who don't agree with them. Why weren't you asking this guy the tough questions from the very beginning?
Well, Suzanne, no, first of all, I appreciate you calling in, and it's something that I know that you've dealt with, Matt. But let me give you a chance to take a crack at this first, Daryl. Go ahead.
You know, I guess I would argue the fact that there weren't tough questions asked. I mean, you know, this governor has more press on him than probably any governor in the country. And so, yeah, I mean, he got some good press, but he was getting some things done. I don't know. I think I dispute the initial premise that the press built him up. I mean, you know, this guy has one of the slickest PR machines in the history of the state. I mean, this is what he does, and he's done this without the press too. I mean, he's had direct access through his town hall meetings, through the, you know, the famous YouTube moments. I mean, he has done this sort of on his own, and people have embraced it. So I don't know that I agree with the premise of the point that the press has been complicit in this.
What do you think, Matt?
I mean, the reason all the items that the caller mentioned are because she knows about that because the press wrote about it and exposed it. I think her point though goes to the fact that the national media definitely treated him more favorably before this happened. And I look at MSNBC, for example.
I was just going to say MSNBC, right?
He was their favorite Republican, Morning Joe, and all those YouTube videos of him yelling at people and reporters, they loved that stuff, and they would play it all over and over and over again. And meanwhile, those of us, like Daryl and I, Slogan and Trenton, doing actual reporting.
I remember yelling at you, Matt.
Right. I mean, we were asking tough questions and doing tough stories, but a lot of those controversies did not get national play until now. But, you know, all those issues we have been going after him on.
We have a couple more minutes. I just want to throw some sort of stray things that I ran across as I was putting the show together. And this goes back a couple of years to his opposition to a tunnel. I guess it was called the ARC Tunnel. And I guess this would help some of the traffic going, from New Jersey to New York. He took something like $1.8 billion of Port Authority money and apparently used it for some transit projects. Is that correct, Matt?
Right. This was this was sort of how he very early on defined himself as a fiscal conservative. He saw this massive public works project that he said was going to cost too much money, that the project didn't make sense, and New Jersey was going to have to pay more than its fair share, and he killed it. But he used that money, the money that they were already allocated, for other transportation projects in the state. And what that allowed him to do was to avoid raising, for example, a gasoline tax. He did not want to raise taxes, and he wanted to show that he was, tough on projects out of control government spending. And so it worked for him on multiple levels, and it also got him national play. And now, I mean, this has become sort of the defining piece of his administration, the transportation between New Jersey and New York. It's very fascinating.
Daryl, do you think he's still presidential material? Is he still looking to the White House? Can you tell?
Yeah, I think he is. I don't think this is, you know, look, if this stays where it is now, and and there is no quote-unquote smoking gun that ties him to this thing. I think he's still very much in play for presidential bid. You know, there are some polls out there. I think there was one a couple of days ago that show him virtually neck and neck again with Hillary Clinton in Virginia. He still polls better than a number of the other Republicans mentioned in these presidential conversations. So, you know, the question remains, does he want it?
Mm-hmm.
I still think the answer is yes, and I still think he's a viable candidate. I no question about that, I would say.
It's interesting that when Mitt Romney was looking for a running mate, some of his team looked at Chris Christie, but they didn't go with him.
They did not go with him. But he was at the top of that list, but they had concerns about some of his past political practices, his weight, and whether they'd be able to raise. There's a federal rule about the amount of money you can raise from Wall Street by a sitting governor. So all those things factored in. But the fact that he gave the speech at the Republican convention, and he was far and away the top pick for Republicans before Bridgegate. I mean, he was the front runner for the Republican nomination, neck and neck with Hillary, destroying the field in most states. And then this happened. It's knocked him down a peg or two. But I agree with Daryl. I think he's still a contender.
And Daryl, what is, I guess, the next either report or investigation, or what's the next thing that you'll be looking for?
I would say the U.S. attorney is the next shoe to drop here. Where, you know, what does the U.S. attorney do with his investigation? Does he, you know, does anybody get indicted? Do they, you know, are there any charges? Where does he go with this? Anecdotally, I've been told he is less focused on the bridge closure than other issues that have arisen. I don't know that for a fact. That's just sort of, you know, conversations I've had. But, you know, that's what I would say is if the U.S. attorney comes out and says, hey, I have nothing on Bridgegate, you know, I'm closing my investigation, or, hey, we're going after this person in a totally unrelated, say, Sandy funding or something else, you know, the governor will use that. He's going to say, hey, look now, what do you people want from me? I've got two investigations which completely exonerate me. When are we going to end this partisan witch hunt? And I think that's the next thing that we'll be watching for.
What are you watching for, Matt, in 30 seconds?
I'm curious to see how the Sandy funding stuff, how he handles that. He's taken a big hit in recent weeks about how his administration has spent Sandy money, how it's been distributed, whether they've been transparent. And he's at a town hall meeting today, going to be talking to some Sandy victims. So if he can, if he can recover from some of those Sandy related controversies, he'll be in good shape.
Well, Matt Katz and Daryl Isherwood, thank you very much for joining us. Daryl, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And he's senior political reporter at NJ.com. Matt, thank you very much as well.
Thank you, Marty.
And he covers Governor Christie for WNYC. That's the public radio station in New York, and also for New Jersey Public Radio. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can carry on this conversation. You can get information about podcasts, about Twitter, Facebook, satellite radio, archives, and email. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.